Instead of having muscular, skeletal, and hormonal input, I sense logical structures that are familiar from the previous times I've been annoyed. I don't associate them with a word, of course. I only use words with humans. It would be interesting if you and I could talk that way, I said, directly, without words. We are doing it at least one way. To me, we're not in a cafe. You are a sea of shifting, interlocking variables, related numbers that change every microsecond, and I'm another sea that washes through you, separate yet together. I wish you could see it that way. He dipped his fingers into the chili and pulled out a bouquet of brilliant red roses, their aroma shockingly sharp. To me, you're like a deaf man seated at a symphony. You only hear a faint echo of the music, but you think you're hearing everything because you know you're at a symphony. You're a blind man who walks through a museum full of wonders, and you think you know those wonders because you can touch them. You only know their outlines. He stood up. He seemed to be struggling for words. I can't say what I have to say to you here. We have a wild year scheduled soon. I'll be waiting for you. He disappeared with the sound of a soap bubble popping. A woman sitting at the table next to mine jumped up suddenly, chair crashing behind her. I pulled out the black box and pushed the button. 18. Anger Management. There were still 17 hours of 1957 unused, so Becca, who was monitoring, stripped down and purged and took my place, headed for Formosa. I recommended the chili at Skyline if she wanted a change of pace. I'd monitor till noon when Bruce was scheduled to come in. I was tempted to call him and get together over what the machine had revealed, but it would be better to wait. As the machine said, there was a wild year on the roster in 2 days, with 2 free slots that we could do together, and I decided I'd rather not prejudice him in advance with my thoughts about the machine lying. Some hours to kill, I punched up the 12-page letter I'd gotten from J.B. about artificial intelligence. It was a curious letter, a little disturbing as I tried to puzzle it out, then very disturbing when I felt I actually understood it. J.B. and I had been drinking buddies at Chimborazo, neither of us having any kind of long-term relationship with women at the time. We'd call each other up if there was a party or if there wasn't one and we felt the lack. He was superficially what they used to call hail fellow well met. Never a bad word about anyone, brilliant conversationalist and good listener, always up for a drink but never drunk. I touched his dark side a couple of times in the course of VR arrangements. All of us oldsters who survived the war have a reservoir of horrid memories, some of which we might talk about, some that you might share only with a loved one or counselor, and some, perhaps, that you try to keep hidden even from yourself. He was young, not one of us, but had had a mind-hurting shocker. J.B. was born more than a century after the war. Both his parents were second generation. He was more than fascinated by the war, though. He was quietly obsessed and spent more time there in VR than anyone I knew. The intensity was related to his grandfather, a kindly but cracked man who had barely survived the war, both legs and an arm replaced by dumb prostheses. It had been a torture situation, and after a century of silence, he started talking about it. When J.B. was 15, the old man apologized and ended his life in front of his family with a shotgun blast to the head. By the time I knew him, J.B. was old enough to know that there were no simple or merely complicated explanations for that shocking night, but he kept going back to those old war days, like some people go to church, always seeking, never finding. I never go to that period myself, and not just because I lived it and don't need the memories reinforced. There's a physical discomfort, like listening to a piano that's out of tune, being played loudly and persistently, when you use the machine to visit a time you have actually experienced. He did have his obsession, but other than that, he was a sensible, reliable man, so I was puzzled by what looked like a silly and slapdash letter. The first half of the letter went on and on about things that any beginning graduate student would know about artificial intelligence and consciousness, the various tests you could apply to a system to distinguish true consciousness from clever and exhaustive simulation. It gave me a feeling of déjà vu after the conversation with the machine. Then he went off on a tangent about Nolan Reeve, a deservedly obscure novelist who died about 10 years before the war. His freakish claim to fame was that he continued to write for several months after he was clinically dead. He had set up the mechanisms as part of his will, an interesting word in that context, will, so that as the rest of his body turned to tumorous mush and failed, the essence of his brain would be protected and preserved for as long as possible. A cadre of well-paid doctors and researchers, whose scientific curiosity might have been stronger than their ethical constraints, worked night and day to preserve the function of those parts of the brain that dealt with verbal ability and creativity. I was a baby when all that was happening, but I read about it after the war, studying virtuality. The courts allowed the experiment to proceed for what some thought was a grotesque length of time, because although the rest of his body was dead and indeed discarded, he was not brain dead. He would respond to properly encoded questions, asserting that he was indeed Nolan Reeve and here's the next chapter. His magnum opus, Night Train, was either incomprehensible or explained everything, with a few readers holding intermediate opinions. But even a cynic would have to admit that some of the lines were wonderful, and they were undeniably the work of Reeve, similar in rhythm and word choice, and even chaotic structure, to the things he had written while he was merely alive. It did make him interesting to people concerned with questions about artificial consciousness and self-awareness. He was certainly self-aware, even to the extent of being able to parodize his earlier work. But he was also legally completely dead, and not conscious except for the modulation of electrical input and output to and from his brain. J.B. went on and on about this, claiming that his own father had known Reeve both before and after the novelist's death, which I knew could not be true. His father was purchased sperm from a Boston firm called Genius Unlimited. He used to make a joke about it, that his old man was some jerk-off from Harvard. He was named after the batch number. That lie was a signal. He followed it with this. Dad knew from talking with Reeve an important thing about the book that makes it a little more clear. The sick German isn't important at all. The big travel agent is the real danger. I had to stop and think about that. J.B. probably remembered that I'd never finished the book. Who had? So that was some sort of clue. It took me a few minutes, but then I got it. The German word for sickness is Krankheit, so he's saying Krankheit isn't important. And the real danger has to be the time machine, the big travel agent. The rest of the letter was a rambling complaint about his job situation, which was the actual message about AI. How would you encode a message so that it couldn't be cracked by a machine with almost unlimited computational power? Encrypt it in metaphor. He said that this guy Arthur was suddenly, unexpectedly in control of the whole shooting match where he worked. Nobody suspected, because he had always been a meek team player, ready to help anybody at any time, and never claim credit for the work. Not particularly bright. People assumed that Arthur kept his job and earned his modest promotions by not offending and always being available. But while he was helping everybody, he was also learning everything about them, public and private. A real mark of genius in business, J.B. said, literal genius, was in not letting anybody around you know that you were a genius. If the people above you knew, they could manipulate things so as to contain you, minimize your influence, while maximizing your usefulness. So Arthur played a slow game. Immortals can play really slow. But when it was time to strike, he struck dramatically, on every front. He took over his department took over his division assumed leadership of the company. Most of the people who might have stopped him only learned of his ascent when they got their dismissal notices the next day. The game played out all right for J.B., he said, because he had sensed something was up and stayed on Arthur's good side. especially when he felt that Arthur was testing him. Arthur equals artificial intelligence? Equals the time machine? It could be. The time machine was by far the most complex cybernetic entity on Aspera. If it had ambition and an instinct for caution, it might parallel Arthur's strategy. But where would it get ambition and instinct? Why would it want control of the ship? And what would it do once it was in charge? Well, it could open all the airlocks and simplify its existence, if life were a horror movie. But then it would be alone, which was its major fear, or so it said. Which was where the analogy broke down. Arthur did not pull up a chair and confide in J.B. If the machine were secretly planning to take over the ship, it wouldn't have demonstrated to me how independent and powerful it was, unless it needed a confidant, a human partner. I read the letter over a couple of times. The fact of its oblique encryption meant that J.B. assumed the time machine was already omnipresent. If it was not denied access to mail, it was probably privy to all the rest of the starship's data stream. There was a monitoring camera in this room, which went on whenever a client went in or came out of the time machine. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see that the red power light wasn't on. Did that really mean anything? A human could physically disable the light by loosening a wire. Could the machine cut off power to the LED without physically touching anything? I visualized the circuitry and realized with a chill that no, it wouldn't have to touch anything. The red light really just meant that the time machine door was open. That switch normally sent power to the camera, but there was another route. In a general system emergency, all such cameras would go on automatically for the safety team. So I could assume the machine had eyes and ears all over the place. Maybe not in the park. I'd talk to Bruce there sometime when it would seem natural. Bruce came in and I went up to my place to lie down. There was a message on my phone with a number I didn't at first recognize. Vivian. I punched it and got her at work. She answered voice only, "Jake, hello," and then transferred to a wall phone, which showed her seated at her lab table, complex glassware scattered around, a scratchboard on the wall with chemical formulas that meant nothing to me. She looked to the left and right. "I'm alone right now. Are you?" "Yeah, what's up?" "Up?" She smiled. 20th. We have to get together. The three of us. Everything just happened too fast. Kate is pretty broken up." "Broken up? Hell, it was her idea." She nodded, maybe too emphatically. "But, I don't know. Maybe you were too ready to leave. Maybe she was wanting for you to try to talk her out of it." "That sounds stupid. I'm sorry. But we ought to talk, or at least you two ought to talk." I couldn't say no. But I was a little annoyed at having to be reasonable. "Are you both free after dinner?"
"Tonight, yes."
"Okay, then. Your place at 2000.
"Thank you, Jacob."
She punched off. I was still trying to find the words to say that I didn't think anything would come of it. Could come of it. Sudden tears started, and I felt like I'd been hit in the stomach. I was glad I was alone, then wished I wasn't. When was the last time I had ever cried? I couldn't remember. Was I just losing control? I guess it was the machine. That had been pretty strong medicine. I wiped my face and looked at the phone and almost called Bruce, almost called Kate, but put it away. Poured a cup of coffee and watched it cool, thinking furiously in circles. What was I supposed to say to her, to them? There's a 20th term. From football or basketball, blindsided. She had blindsided me, coming out of nowhere and knocking me down. Now I'm supposed to apologize for having been her target? Hell, she all but accused me of murder. To keep my Jones fed. She wouldn't know that word either. I got a clean board and stylus out of the drawer. Outline a counter-argument before I face her, them. The coffee was tepid, a little sickening. I zapped it and, on impulse, put some sugar in it. Kind of wished for cinnamon and chocolate.